Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is George Pendle, who has a biography, Strange Angel, The Otherworldly Life of Rocket Scientist John Whiteside Parsons. First off, George Pendle, you're a journalist in England or in America?
That's right. I used to work full-time for the London Times. Now I just freelance for various publications back in England, Sunday Times, Financial Times, and so on.
Parsons was a very strange man. He was a leading rocket scientist who was also Aleister Crowley's man in Los Angeles, and he was also the landlord, and we'll go into this in some depth, of L. Ron Hubbard during a period when Hubbard was supposedly doing research for what later became Dianetics. What attracted you, or how did you find out about John Whiteside Parsons?
It was really when I was working on a subject quite unconnected to Parsons. I was writing on the avant-garde filmmaker Kenneth Anger, and in an article I was reading about him, there was a footnote that one of his actresses had been married to an eccentric rocket scientist who had blown himself up in his home laboratory shortly after the Second World War. Just really piqued my interest, and I decided to look into the story, and the more I looked, the more I discovered the strange and fascinating story which ended up in the book.
You said you began reading about this woman and you began looking. Where did you begin looking? Did you just go online and look up John Parsons' name? How did that work?
Well, to begin with, it really was, the quick Google search. The occult community, the occult organization which Parsons was a member of, still exists to this day. And in fact, they have been almost much more comprehensive archivers of John Whiteside Parsons or Jack Parsons' myth than the science world, which he was really a pioneer in. I eventually went to the OTO archives, the Ordo Templi Orientis archives, and discovered a wealth of information about Parsons, which, when I went to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory archives in Pasadena, the OTO really put the JPL to shame. So it was really just starting with very basic primary sources, trying to find people who knew him, both in the scientific world and in the occult world.
You stumbled upon, she's deceased now, his first wife, Helen, and you did a very extensive interview with her?
I interviewed Helen Parsons up in Truckee in Northern California, and I spent a week with her, slowly but surely, trying to find various aspects of her relationship with Parsons and also her relationship with the OTO.
There's also the science fiction element, because many of these people were fans, and of course L. Ron Hubbard was a science fiction writer, and Jack Parsons was friends with both Robert Heinlein and L. Sprague de Camp, and he also knew Jack Williamson. Had you had any contact prior to the Parsons story with the world of science fiction? Had you read science fiction?
Well, growing up, I read Asimov, I read Bradbury, I read kind of, the kind of classics of science fiction. It was interesting when I started looking at Parsons' story that it was really, science fiction was really the only basis in which rocketry, the science which he chose to study, had any kind of background. The scientific world looked down on rocketry. It didn't even treat it as a proper science. In fact, the only people who treated rocketry as a science and as a real, genuine possibility were the science fiction authors, people like Jack Williamson, as you say.
One thing I found fascinating is that one of the reasons we talk about jet research now rather than rocket research is because they almost coined the word jet because they were afraid of the word rocket.
That's right. At the time, the word rocket was so looked down upon as being in the province of science fiction that when Parsons and his group of rocketeers, who were known as the Suicide Squad, when they developed their first rockets, they had to name them jet-assisted takeoff rockets because the actual word rocket was looked down upon by both government and academics alike.
Jack Parsons was an autodidact. He pretty much taught himself. Well, he went to college a little bit. And he got involved in rocketry just basically in the backyard, right?
That's right. He was inspired by science fiction magazines, which he even tried to copy some of the designs of rockets which were written about in the science fiction magazines. But he had no formal education. His school history was spotty. He moved from school to school. He spent just less than 1 year at university before dropping out. And really, it was the bravura of the man just walking into Caltech, the California Institute of Technology, one day, and just saying, hey, I'd like to build some rockets. Do you have anybody who's doing this? And of course, they said no. And he finally found, a few like-minded spirits at Caltech to help him out.
How did you find out about this? Because you said if the Jet Propulsion Lab's archives were spotty, mm-hmm. Did this come from Helen? Or?
Well, no. Fortunately, there was one archivist at the JPL, the late Dr. John Bluth, who had desperately been trying to resurrect the birth of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, trying to find out the true founders, of which Parsons was one. And through speaking to him and, of course, getting in contact with people like Helen, I slowly kind of pieced together the people who were in the original rocketry group that founded the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
putting this into context, he was born in 1914.
That's correct.
And died in 52.
52, at the age of 37, yeah.
Grew up in Pasadena in a very wealthy community, which is now, I guess, tract homes.
A lot of the mansions along the street on which he lived, Orange Grove Avenue, have been torn down. I mean, at the time he was growing up there, it was known as Millionaire's Row. I think they had 53 millionaires in a mile and a half stretch of road. It was remarkable. And Parsons lived a very kind of rich and solitary and spoiled childhood on this street. But now the old mansions which used to line that street have become condos, small homes, and Jack Parsons' famous mansion in which he and his occult group lived has also been demolished.
His family suffered from the crash, and there was no money after that. That was one of the reasons he couldn't go off to college. And he got involved in rocketry. Now, at that particular time, it was mostly just the province of science fiction, except for Robert Goddard.
That's correct. Robert Goddard was possibly the one man in the world at the time, really, who was obsessed with making rockets work. And he was very much this sole prophet. He had been working on rockets since the 10s and 20s up in Massachusetts, but the academic authorities as well as the governmental authorities had kind of forced him into an almost kind of exile down in New Mexico. He was working there by himself, had been lambasted in the press, had been lambasted by his academic peers, and he really was just working solely for himself to try and make rockets, and he wasn't willing to share any of his information with anybody else. It was the tragic kind of story which Parsons had to face, was that the one man who could have helped him wasn't willing to lend him any help because he was so afraid that he would be criticized once more.
The other people involved were a guy named Frank Molina and a guy named Edward Forman?
Edward Forman, yes, that's right.
And a Chinese man named Cian?
Cian, yeah.
And this was in the mid-30s at the height of the Depression. George Pendle, you discuss also their politics. Molina and Forman were pretty clearly leftists. I think Molina was a communist?
In Pasadena at the time, and especially around the California Institute of Technology, there was a great drive to try and sort out the social problems brought about by the Depression, and a communist cell was set up in Pasadena, of which Molina, Cian, and Forman, and Parsons all attended. Parsons didn't really take to the communist doctrine too well. He was much more free-thinking, much more philosophical, it seemed. He didn't really want to toe a party line. And indeed, his fellow rocket scientists eventually slipped away from the Communist Party before the Second World War began.
Do you have any writings of Parsons on politics at the time?
Parsons wrote, perhaps most famously, at least amongst the occult group, a tract called Freedom is a Two-Edged Sword, which begins as very much a social commentary and a social discussion of the failings of society, but which, as you begin to read through it, you realize is a much more occultist tract than it initially appeared. You know, by the end of it, he's saying that the only way to solve the crisis in economics and in politics in the world in the late 40s and early 50s is by summoning the goddess Babylon to appear in the world, which is, of course, what Parsons ended up trying to do.
Had he always been interested in it then?
He says that in his memoirs, which are very brief and spotty, but he said that at the age of 13, he had attempted to summon the devil in his bedroom in Pasadena. Whether that was a forerunner to his future interest in occultism or merely a piece of self-mythologizing is hard to work out, but I think he'd always been attracted, partly because L.A. had had this great kind of spiritual and, religious extremism there. You have to understand there were evangelists, there were Buddhists, there were all manner of new and exciting religions which people like Parsons could go down the road and study, and this was the 30s, and these ideas were brand sparkling and new.
At a certain point, he got in touch with Crowley through a man named Wilfred T. Smith. Wilfred T. Smith was head of the OTO at the time in L.A.?
He was kind of Crowley's missionary in Los Angeles, and Crowley had given him the leadership banner to start up the Agape Lodge, as it was known, in Los Angeles. Wilfred Smith was seen by Crowley as being his gateway to having a great successful religion. Crowley very much thought that the United States was perfect, ripe for the plucking, so to speak. And he really wanted to try and bring in as many film people, as many scientists, as many grand men of Los Angeles as he possibly could to further his religion of Thelema, as it was known.
Which was not Satanism, which is kind of how we remember Crowley today, but it was not that at all.
No, it wasn't really. I mean, Crowley at the time was, renowned for being the wickedest man in the world, and his doctrine of Thelema, it had a rather ambiguous creed. The creed was, "Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law." Crowley always stressed that this was really for personal and spiritual advancement. A lot of commentators and indeed his own disciples saw it as as, you know, a free card to go live bohemian and have open relationships and do whatever they wanted to do.
The image I got in reading Strange Angel, George Pendle, is a latter-day version of that weird surreal scene in Eyes Wide Shut, the Stanley Kubrick movie. You know, it's not exactly erotic. It's just kind of people with masks and things like that. Is that kind of...
Well, I think so. There was a certain kind of play element about it all. You know, everybody was in their 20s. It was a wild time. Everybody wanted to try every experience they possibly could. I mean, there was a lot of sex and sex magic going on, this whole idea that you could move your mind to a kind of higher level of consciousness through the act of sex. But it kind of had a naive quality to it, I think. I think the people who took part in it really thought that they were, you know, as so many people who join religious organizations like this, really thought it could help them progress and become better people.
It sounds as if what was going on was not really that much different than what was going on in the late 60s.
No, I think you're right. I think it's no surprise that Crowley gained a great kind of revival in the 60s. You know, he appeared on the cover of Sgt. Pepper. His books came back into print. It was really like the start of the free love kind of decade, but 30 years before it actually happened, I think, in Los Angeles in the 1930s.
And by day, Jack Parsons was busy trying to create rocket fuel. That was his specialty, right?
He was a master chemist of genius while he was at Caltech, and he was called upon by the academics and the local government to kind of give advice on explosions. Parsons understood that explosions weren't just these arbitrary, you know, expansion of material. They were kind of a symphony which he could control and combine and place in his rockets to give them a certain amount of thrust.
The breakthrough came about by discovering the property of asphalt.
Up until then, rockets were either powered by solid fuel, which was like gunpowder, or liquid fuel, things like liquid oxygen or liquid hydrogen being pumped into the rocket itself. Now, Parsons one day was walking along the Arroyo Seco, the dry river valley in Pasadena, and saw some men pouring some asphalt roofing tar onto a house down the road. Suddenly something clicked in his mind, and he saw that asphalt itself could be the basis for a new type of rocket fuel, not solid, not liquid, but somewhere in between, the castable fuel as it's known. By mixing an oxidizer with the asphalt, he realized that they could pour this new fuel, actually pour it into the liquid casing where it would harden, and this would spark off a rocket which was much more powerful and much more controllable than anything that had come before.
George Pendle. Now we move toward World War II. Suddenly the Caltech people are working for the military. At this point in his private life, had he moved into his own mansion by 1939-40?
By 1939-1940, he was still living with his wife in Pasadena, but his interest in the occult had been growing, and there were now tensions between himself and his wife. Having become a member of the OTO, the open marriage was very much put forward as being the way to live. And it wasn't going to be long before Parsons himself became the leader of the OTO group and eventually would bring them all to Pasadena to live in this giant ramshackle mansion on Orange Grove Avenue.
The mansion is now known as the Parsonage. You mentioned the Parsonage obliquely at the very end, just before they move out. Was it not known as that during most of the period?
Not particularly. I believe that some of the OTO group did refer to it as the Parsonage. I don't think Parsons ever did himself. But it kind of had the right tone, the slightly religious, but also playing on Parsons' name.
Now we move into the realm of just plain weirdness. Somehow Crowley had a falling out with Wilfred Smith and wanted to get rid of Smith, get Smith out of the building. By this time, Parsons had already taken over the OTO and used the most bizarre method of getting him out of the building.
Crowley was very upset that Wilfred Smith, in all his years of leading the OTO, hadn't yet found him like the rich men to spread the religion widely, and went about getting rid of Smith by declaring that Smith was a god. Crowley said that Smith was an unknown god, and that Smith had to go into the desert and find out exactly which god he was before he could return, and until then, nobody in the OTO could speak to him. So this was his brilliant way of getting rid of Smith. Crowley's word at the time was sacred. Everybody had to follow what Crowley said. And so Smith found himself framed almost, He had been flattered and told that he was a god, yet it meant he had to leave his home and indeed his family and the religious cult he was the head of and head out into the desert until he had found out his true divine nature.
Do we have proof that that was what Crowley believed? Are there letters Crowley saying, I'm getting rid of this guy?
Well, there are, but Crowley was such a strange character that you could never tell what he really believed in, and I think from day to day it shifted itself. I mean, he does write to Carl Germer, who was the head of the OTO in America as a whole, and say, you know, I think we have dealt with the Smith problem. But then in other letters he says, no, I truly do believe that Smith is a god. The whole problem with Crowley and with Crowley's religion is that it often contradicts itself on numerous occasions and on numerous facts.
You're listening to an interview with George Pendle, whose book is Strange Angel, about the life of Jack Parsons. Did Parsons take a lot of drugs during that period? Was he doing cocaine, amphetamines?
There seems to be some kind of eyewitness evidence that he was certainly taking amphetamines at the time, and a poem which Parsons wrote at the time would seem to suggest that he was involved in these substances. I believe it goes, I hight Don Quixote, I live on peyote, marijuana, morphine, and cocaine. I never knew madness, but only a sadness that burns at the heart and the brain. And I think from that kind of poem which Parsons wrote, you kind of understand that I think he probably was indulging in all manner of chemicals.
And we have to keep in mind that at the time he was 25, 26 years old. He was, he was still quite young.
Yeah. Well, it was the time for experimentation, and Parsons really believed that his life should be experimented with in terms of magic and in terms of religion as much as the rockets he was working on at Caltech.
And then the war came along, and during the war he was working for the U.S. government, basically.
Finally, the government had realized that actually rockets might be quite a useful thing to have. The Suicide Squad, as they had known, had invented a rocket which they could attach to the bombers and so on in the Second World War, which would allow them to take off over short distances, these heavily laden bombers. These rockets were called JATOs, jet-assisted takeoff rockets. At the time, the V-1 and V-2 rockets made by the Nazis, the German rocket scientists, had yet to be used, so rocketry was slowly becoming used by the American military in this takeoff assistance task.
And at the time, because of the focus on the war, private life was crazier and wilder and less controlled everywhere.
Yeah, so I think there was a real kind of carpe diem element, It was like, let's, play hard and live hard now, because who knows what may happen. If you think that you may not live, till the end of the year, you think, well, a religious sex cult stands just up my street. Let's give this a go for the weekend.
During that period, a lot of non-OTO people began coming in. I mean, he had contact with DeCamp, Heinlein. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't all Crowley people, and certainly was pals with his leftist rocket scientist friends.
And his giant mansion, which had, 14, 15 bedrooms, he really invited anybody he found interesting or exciting, or he even put an advert in the local paper calling for atheists to come along and interview for a room in the house. There were not only rocket scientists like Parsons, there were science fiction fans, science fiction authors, there were nuclear physicists working for the Manhattan Project, all under this one roof. It was an extraordinary house, and Parsons really was at the top of his game. He was the kind of big top kind of leader of this incredible circus.
And at that particular time, along comes a man named L. Ron Hubbard. Hubbard at that point was a science fiction writer, red-haired, which is actually interesting because I interviewed years ago and I knew a man named Alva Rogers who also lived in the house. He was like 17 years old. Hubbard apparently told him that redheads were somehow special people and therefore he was going to confide in Alva.
I hadn't heard that, but L. Ron Hubbard did seem to have, a story for everybody. He was so charismatic that people really just fell at his knees and listened to whatever he said and truly believed it. Parsons, for one, fell completely under his spell, his tales of adventures going to Australia. Apparently he could lift up his shirt and show scars gained from Aboriginal arrows. I mean, ridiculous, but not quite ridiculous stories. Rather like Crowley, Hubbard seemed to be a fake, but not entirely a fake. There were just these kernels of truth which he could drag out and just knock you down with if you questioned him too much.
And then Hubbard decided to put the moves on Parsons' girlfriend, the sister of Parsons' wife.
Parsons thought that he could get Hubbard to be a member of the OTO because he thought that Hubbard had this great charisma and would be a very useful addition to the occult group. But little did he realize that Hubbard had other ideas and slowly put the moves on Betty Northrup, who was Parsons' girlfriend at the time, which made Parsons exceedingly distraught. Despite the fact that the OTO preached a doctrine of not being jealous about sexual relations, Parsons just couldn't stop himself from feeling jealous about the fact that, a man who he considered his best friend, L. Ron Hubbard, had just walked in and stolen his girlfriend.
There's a story you tell about Hubbard and Betty, the girlfriend, absconding with Parsons' money gained from the sale of the parsonage, going to Florida, buying boats, and just living the high life. Now, I looked in Barefaced Messiah, which is probably the best biography of Hubbard that's out there, and I think his name is Russell Miller, kind of avoids the actual events. Where did you get that specific information?
I found a court case which took place in Miami, where Hubbard and Betty had run off to. It showed the kind of details of what actually happened. Hubbard and Parsons had entered into a business arrangement for a company called Allied Enterprises, in which Parsons would put all the proceeds from his rocketry work and Hubbard would put all the proceeds from his science fiction writing. In the court documents, you soon find out that what actually happened was Hubbard took the money, invested in these boats, and just didn't go back to Parsons, just was living the high life. And it's all stated in black and white in these legal documents.
Alva Rogers was afraid of the Scientologists. I get the impression they're not as litigious these days as they used to be.
Certainly they have been in the past known for stamping down on authors who've questioned the official history of Scientology quite strongly. But one hopes that they're willing, you know, at least to admit that perhaps L. Ron Hubbard wasn't quite as angelic as the picture they paint.
You hope.
Although, who knows?
Have you had any word from them?
I had a brief couple of phone calls before I came out to the West Coast congratulating me on my work of fiction. But I'm told that they have some secret documents which have just been discovered, which will show that L. Ron Hubbard, rather than being an unscrupulous con man, was in fact working for the American government to destroy black magic in America. So I'm very much looking forward to studying those documents.
How do the OTO people view the book?
The OTO have been incredibly helpful in the book. I myself am not an occultist, but I am very interested in the subject of belief. And the OTO have kept great records and very much want to keep their name in the public eye, so they've been more than willing to help with Parsons.
After the war, Parsons was caught in the blacklist, and he was thrown out of rocketry.
There was a scientific blacklist, and many of the members of Parsons' Suicide Squad, which were working on rocketry back in the 30s, were caught up in this. Frank Molina eventually had to flee the country, despite having been the director of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Tsien, the Chinese rocket scientist most famously, was expelled from the country, having been kept in house arrest for 5 years, purely, it seems, because he was Chinese. It was a strange and horrible time, because the real pioneers of rocketry in America were being expelled from the science they had helped to create. Ironically, they were replaced by the German rocket scientists, the communists were replaced by fascists. I mean, it's a strange state of affairs. Parsons, couldn't escape that horrible witch hunt.
And he tried over the years, but gradually things got worse for him. They didn't get better, though he got some jobs here and there.
He did. He got the odd job here and there, but slowly but surely his kind of maverick methods weren't really in keeping with the way rocketry had progressed.
Well, we'll get to his death now, but first, had he lived, what direction do you think he would have gone in?
He was only 37, but he had taken this kind of precipitous fall, at least in his professional life, from grace. Towards the end of his life, he had been trying to work on a job, to get a job in Israel, to work on rockets for the new state of Israel. So he could have ended up being the father of the Israeli rocketry system. It's hard to tell. He could have ended up writing, these great libertarian tracts on freedom. Who knows where he might have gone?
Parsons' death, he was in an explosion. George Pendle, you speculate pretty much that his hand slipped.
Well, it's a kind of Occam's razor. Whatever is the simplest argument is probably the truest one. There were a lot of rumors after his death, partly because of his personal life and partly because of his involvement with communist witch hunts, that he had been murdered or that he had been involved in some occult experiment to summon a homunculus, which had gone horribly wrong. Some people said that instead of summoning a homunculus, he summoned a fire demon which consumed him. But ultimately, really, his wits were fraying, and he really wasn't paying attention in his explosive work in the same manner as he had before. The people who knew him in the last moments of his life, who were living in the same building as him, describe him as being slightly jittery, anxious to escape L.A. for a holiday in Mexico, and kind of rushing against the clock to finish these experiments. And it seems that, well, perhaps Parsons had always lived close to the edge in his rocketry experiments, and finally, that kind of dangerous side just caught up with him.
George Pendle. In doing a biography you're often stuck with different interpretations, different stories. How do you sort through it?
It's a long process of kind of cross-referencing and trying to find, you know, the few points in everybody's interpretation which kind of rings true. I tried to avoid the sensational except where I couldn't, where the facts were just so behind that interpretation that I had to go with it. Unfortunately, Parsons' story has been kind of mythologized over the years since his death. The truth really is just as weird and bizarre as all the mythology that's grown up around him.
In 1999, a book came out called Love and Rockets, written by a pseudonymous man named John Carter. We don't have to reveal his real name, but we do know it. It's not a name anyone would recognize. You did not know about this book when you began working.
No, I didn't. I mean, I really started, you know, going through the rocketry background and the occult background, but eventually I did. Of course, I happened upon it. I wanted to treat Parsons as very much a scientist foremost and show how the links between his professional life and his private life, there wasn't all that much difference. Parsons really saw rocketry and magic as being two sides of the same coin. Both had been derided, but he thought he could conquer both. Sex and Rockets is more of the occult mythologizing. It describes the religious rituals which he performed in. But for a real understanding of the man, I thought it was lacking from it. And I hope that's what Strange Angel kind of tells the story of. I know that there was, you know, one rumor which Carter puts in his book about certain videotapes which were found of Parsons and his mother in compromising situations. But when I went back to try and find that out, I found it was really nothing more than hearsay.
Was it hard to keep your own personal judgments about the people or the groups out of the book?
Not really. I tried to approach the book as openly minded as possible. I didn't want to judge Parsons for his belief in the occult and in magic, because I don't think you should have to judge him for that any more than you should judge him for being interested in rockets. I think it's all part of, you know, this untamed imagination.
Did you find yourself having difficulty trying to balance the scientific / historical and the sensational?
Not really, because I think the scientific side was partly influenced by the environment around him. You have to realize, like, Los Angeles at the time was this place of religious and scientific extremism. And it was just as sensational, really, as Parsons' story itself. You know, Einstein was attending seances in Beverly Hills. Amy Semple McPherson, the great evangelist of the time, was doing exorcisms over the new technology of the radio. Edwin Hubble, the astronomer, could be found dining with Harpo Marx. It was a weird time when the boundaries between disciplines were much more porous.
George Pendle, what are you working on now?
Something entirely different, completely different. I'm hoping it's going to be the biography of the 13th President of the United States, a man who nobody knows about at all, called Millard Fillmore. Due to some hidden diaries and newly undiscovered letters, I found that Millard Fillmore was much more a part of his time than anybody could possibly imagine. And I hope to reveal the rather sensational character of the 13th President in my next book.
Do you feel that being from England either helps or hinders writing about Americans?
Well, I think it allows a certain objectivity. Certainly in the next book I'm going to study the office of the presidency is something which we in England find very unusual and indeed slightly fascinating, the way in which it's held by people as being an almost godlike position. And with Parsons itself, I don't know, maybe it's the British love of Americana. We find it fascinating when people have been forgotten by American history because of their eccentric lives.
You've been listening to an interview with George Pendle, whose book is Strange Angel, The Otherworldly Life of Rocket Scientist John Whiteside Parsons. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.